especially research that will be geared to make them more sustainable cities, and especially anything that's got to do with bicycles. Robin, as such, is the author of several art packages, including for sustainable transport cities, and of course he's one of the main contributors to the SF package, which is going to become the main way that we deal with spatial objects in art. He's also written several books, one of which will be for the lucky prize winner of the Flash Talks this morning, and one of his newest books, Geo Computation and Art, In the Spirit of Art, is reproducible. It's online, and it's going to be ready quite soon, I think. So without any more words from me, it's a real pleasure to present to you Robin Lovelace with Geo Computation with Art, Empowering Yourself in Open Source Software.
Okay, thank you very much for the introduction. I would like to start by saying that part of the intro wasn't true. I definitely wouldn't say I'm one of the main contributors to the SF package, which is written by Edson Pobezla, which is a phenomenal thing. I help with the documentation and I help break it. And that's kind of my attitude to our development. I think it's really important to contribute and to communicate what is going on, and you need an entire community of users. So I think in the art ecosystem, to some extent, my role is more about communication than actual hardcore software development. But I have got slightly into the development of art over time, and I'm going to touch upon that and how I've my experience of using art and seeing how you can use it for policy relevant applications. But as Christian said, I have quite a focus on geospatial data, so that's why I'm going to call it's about geocomputation with R, and with an emphasis on how you can empower yourself to do things with the amazing amount of geographic data that is now available, which is quite astounding how quickly data sets have grown. Can I just get a check? Can you hear me okay at the back? Is the mic level okay? That's good. And can I just get a little check? Who actually uses spatial data, or are most people in here? So just raise your hand if you consider yourself a spatial R person. Okay, right, so I'd say that's almost half, and that's good, because I am going to go into some of the packages and we are going to see some code, and maybe, if you're lucky, a live demo. But that cannot always be guaranteed to work. So I don't know why no one else has picked up on this, but the Northwest University R Day has the acronym NERD spelled with a U. So I called this talk NERD with a U, which is quite funny. And going to an event with that acronym, I don't feel at all ashamed about putting loads of code on there, making lots of geeky jokes. So the first one is, the structure of my talk here is illustrated by the str function, which means structure. And as you can see, it's a list of four parts. So it's a four-part talk. I'm just going to provide an introduction, a bit about myself, and also the context of geodata, the R spatial ecosystem, which has evolved quite rapidly recently. And I'm going to touch on that and what's possible. And it really is an exciting time to be working with spatial data in R because of the rate of development of some of this stuff. I'm going to try and do a bit of a live demo. So actions speak louder than words sometimes is the explanation of that. And then just kind of, this is more a discussion point that should lead nicely onto the questions. How can we make our use of R relevant to policy? So providing evidence-based policy is going to be the final part. So I'm going to start this off by saying that a lot of this, the content of this talk, and I guess anyone using open source software, is part of a wider team. And the particular geocomputation in our project is by myself, Jakub Nowosad, who's from Poland, Janis, who's from Germany, and myself. And I think it's quite illustrative of how the R community is consolidating and it's becoming more international, and it's more easy than ever before to collaborate with people in different places. And we all kind of met and have kind of become friends through this book project. And we a lot of the content of this is also shared by them. So this is part of a project that I'm going to touch on later, but we're still looking for input and any feedback on this open source, open access book project is still possible. Another geeky joke, does anyone get this? Who am I? So, who am I is a Linux command that you ask the system, who am I? And that's just a kind of in joke. But basically, a little bit about me, I'd say I'm an environmental geographer, so I don't draw a hard distinction between physical geography doing glaciers or human cultural geography is only allowed to look at human phenomenon. I believe strongly that we are in closely interlinked with natural processes, and I believe, and that's why I love geography as something that allows you to combine the kind of hard sciences and maybe bring in to policy some of the lessons from that science. So that is a very interesting interface where you can deal with lots of data coming from both human systems and the environmental systems. And that's how I see geography. I've got a little GIF of myself there that was generated using open source software, and this is a new package called GIFSKI, written by Jeroen Ooms, that is amazingly good at creating GIFs. So if anyone likes doing that, that's fine, but I just thought I'd put that on there to show that I do have an interest outside of academia and programming, so I just thought I'd put that on for a bit of fun. But the more serious question is why this focus on geographic data that I have and that I'm going to have in this talk. I think there's good reasons for it. Geographic data is everywhere, and despite the digital revolution reducing the distances between people, it's still a massively important part of everyday life, and it still has a huge impact on your life chances and your experiences of the world where you are. And from the data side, geographic data is ubiquitous and it's growing in volume very, very quickly. So it's something that we should, that has a huge impact on society. Another great thing about geographic data from the other side, if you do analyses that operate at the global level, the geographic component allows you to show how it relates to people in your local area. So for example, if you do an analysis that shows you've got this model that shows how we can transition away from fossil fuels, and it's all very hypothetical, if you can manage to make that model run for a local area, and then I speak to someone in Manchester, say, and say, this is what Manchester could look like, it's a great way of communicating the research down to people who are who will experience that as a much more kind of localized thing. So it's a way to give meaning, local meaning, to information, and that's something that maps can really do. So this is just a small example from the Propensity to Cycle tool, which is a web application that I that I'm the lead developer of it, and I'm going to risk trying to do a very quick demo of this, seeing if it's going to load up. So this is an example of a model that operates on a big level that we've applied locally. So this runs across all of the country, but if I go to Andy Burnham or policymakers in Manchester and say, oh, I've got this solution, I've got this model that uses distance decay curves and it uses a regression model and it can change transport policy, they're probably going to come to me and say, what are you talking about? Whereas if you can say, look, this is Manchester, do you know this part of Manchester? Our results suggest that this specific road would benefit from having cycle infrastructure on it. Suddenly it has a new kind of meaning. So I'm not going to go into what this map shows and what it does, but I will very quickly go on to probably the most important layer on there, which possibly should be easier to get to, but this is the road network layer on the Propensity Cycle tool, and we can use these modelling techniques to imagine what the future would be like. So very specific to Manchester, there's a huge amount of investment planned for increasing walking and cycling in the city. And there's being Manchester, you've gone and called it the B-Lines project. So you're going to have loads of B-Lines connecting different parts of Manchester. I think this map that's currently being shown provides a good estimate of places where there's high demand for cycle infrastructure. So I'm not saying this is where the B-Lines will or should go, but it gives a very good indication of the kind of spatial distribution of an optimal cycle network for Manchester. And I know for a fact that Transport for Greater Manchester have used the propensity to cycle tool as part of their strategic planning around the investment of cycling. So that's just one example and a slight detour, but it really brings home the message to me of how to why geographic data analyses can make a difference. And I seem to have lost my slides, so I'm going to have to go back and hopefully it'll reopen my slides. Yep, there we go. So geographic data can be highly policy relevant, especially for local policymakers. And if you're struggling to have policy impact, it's something that I've experienced. If you're like lobbying to the powers that be at the top of the global economy, it just feels like you're not going to get through. But if you realise that there's also a lot of decisions are made locally, you might have more traction with local decision making. And I think that geographic data and scaling down big models is a really important way to try and engage with kind of the local decision making process. So the message there is that R can help tackle big issues, and I've got a spinning world there to represent that. Geocomputation with R provides new tools that can help us do new things with geographic data. So rabbit out of a hat, that's why we wrote Geocomputation with R. It's an open source book project that tries to teach recent methods and packages for dealing with spatial data. And I emphasize it's more about communication than actually developing stuff, because myself, Yanis and Jakub, who I mentioned earlier, we're all really into this kind of ecosystem. We try and help the upstream developers like Edza Pobezma, but we don't regard ourselves as the main developers of the most important packages. So just a kind of heads up about the book. It's a book that we've been working on for about 2 years now. It's completely available online and it's completely open source, but it will also be published as a hard copy by CRC Press. And this number's changed. It was going to be late 2018, but we've just sent it to copy editing, so it's going to be early 2019 now. Could I just get confirmation, Christian, when you said a book will be made available to the winner, are you talking about that book?
No.
Okay. That's good, because it's not ready yet. So it's up and coming, and I think maybe you can pre-order it. So what is geocomputation? And I get really frustrated with academics who use terms, especially when they're not in the Oxford English Dictionary, and just use them without telling you what they mean by them. So I'm not going to do that. I'm going to say what I mean by geocomputation. Or rather, I'm going to tell you what Stan Openshaw means by geocomputation. So it's about using the various types of geodata and developing relevant geotools within a new word there, so sorry, there's a new word in the definition, within the overall context of a scientific approach. And I like that, partly because it's very broad, and I think geocomputation is very broad, but it's about developing tools. It's not just about doing analysis. You write a script, you do an analysis on one piece of data, and then you forget the script. You're building tools that help other people use the data, and that's kind of the thinking that underlies the propensity to cycle tool, which has an R package underlying it, which is kind of decoupled from the propensity to cycle tool that anyone can use to do geographic analysis of transport data. We have kind of tweaked that, so we don't we think there's a lot of good ingredients in there, but one difference in our definition is reproducibility. So when Stan Openshaw was writing about geocomputation, he really was a visionary guy. He was predicting a lot of the things that have subsequently happened. But one of the things that he didn't predict was the massive rise of open source software, enabling all of the analysis that he was talking about to be reproducible on your laptop. So we just say it was unrealistic at the time when they were running lines of Fortran code on mainframe computers to kind of handle a few megabytes of data. That was completely unrealistic to imagine that that would be possible to compile the program, let alone run the program on laptops. Whereas now, the amazing thing is we can all do very advanced spatial data analysis on completely huge data sets compared with what they were using. So we are in a new world compared with when the term was first defined around 1998. There's some other aspects of the definition geocomputation, which I won't dwell on too long, but it's creativity, and that's something why you would want to use a programming language like R to do geocomputation. So it's kind of linked in with this idea of geographic information systems, but if you know the GIS literature, it's very based around the graphical user interface, whereas R is a programming language, and by enabling you to create new tools at quite a low level, you can remove constraints on your creativity imposed by software. So we do take the term geocomputation quite seriously, and that's just a little bit about it, and that kind of segues into the rest of the talk. So the book itself, we have a logo for it now, and we put out a logo competition, and someone came up with this meta hex sticker thing, so that's what that is. But we kind of give a bit of more of the history, so if you're interested in the history of software, there's a lot in there, including contributions by Roger Bivant, who's one of the forefathers of spatial data analysis in R. And then we have broken it into three parts: foundations, which gives you the really kind of strong like class definitions and how to do the basic spatial and non-spatial operations on data. And then we talk about some more advanced methods in the extensions bit, and that includes advanced visualization, so making web maps of the type that I presented in the propensity to cycle tool, and also how to build your own functions, so what if you want to build some of your own geo tools. And there's also a little bit on statistical learning, so moving towards the machine learning with geographic data in there. So there's a whole load of things in the book, and we try and teach it in a way that is accessible. And basically that's a bit of a plug for the book, that it's all out there and you can take a look. So moving on to our spatial ecosystem, half of the people in the audience, as we established, use spatial data. So for the benefit of people who don't, and as a kind of reinforce for people who do and a little bit of history, I'm going to do a very quick whistle-stop tour of the spatial R ecosystem. So software for data science is evolving, and it's fair to say that the Tidyverse has had a huge impact on R overall. I saw a recent post that showed that almost all of the top 10 packages by downloads are from the Tidyverse. So the Tidyverse really is having a huge amount of uptake, and it's making data science more accessible to a new generation of people. So that's been quite a big change in the R world, and it's really kind of put pressure on people using spatial data to adapt to this kind of new way of working. And it's basically led to demand for the spatial data classes to be able to handle Tidyverse functions. So that's going to be the basis of some of the code demos later on, and that's a representation of the tidyverse. There's a whole load of packages in there, but none of them are spatial. The great news is that there's actually integration now between the cutting edge spatial data class system called Simple Features. Well, it's two years old now, so maybe not so cutting edge, but very high performance, and it's a rewrite of previous packages. So this really has made the kind of work that I do much easier and faster. So for anyone out there who hasn't heard of SF and wants to get into spatial data, I can strongly recommend that as a package. But going back a little bit, for a previous talk, I tried to find working code, the oldest working R code for spatial data that I could. And I found this package from 1993, which is still running. I'm not gonna try a live demo of this now, but basically what it allowed you to do is plot on the map a series of points, and then you could press zoom. If you type that zoom button, it doesn't zoom, it waits for you to click on two points on the screen, and then it jumps to that screen. So it's like a very early version of interactive web maps where you can like zoom in and zoom out, but you had to do it manually, which is quite fun. So if anyone wants to do that, so it gives you a little map like that, and let's say you want to zoom in on these points, then you can do that. And you could say that's very rudimentary, but for me, but I think it's impressive that you can do that kind of interactivity back in 1993. What's even more impressive for me is that the code still runs today on modern R installations. So that shows that hopefully in 20 years time, all of the code that we're writing will still run. So the people developing these software packages, they know what they're doing, and they're guaranteeing that it's going to be compatible with future in the future. Observations, yeah, R is robust and future-proof, as I just said. There's also a video of Roger Bivand doing a live demo, which is the scariest live demo I've seen, of him compiling R0.49, which I can't remember, I think that might have been from 1998, and it still runs today. So this shows that when we mean reproducibility, when we say reproducibility, we mean it, and we mean it in the long term as well. But it also shows that R's capabilities, and especially spatial capabilities, have evolved quite dramatically since then. So I'm going to give a few more examples of that. And a case study is geographic data visualization. Obviously, R spatial is a big area, but something that's very easy to show and represent is the geographic data visualization. And as a geographer, this is basically my favorite part of my job, is making maps. It's really satisfying to make a nice map, and especially one that you can share with other people that tells a story. So let's just go back to see how geographic data visualization. I decided to go back further than 1993 this time, to about a few hundred years BC, to the first maps, which were carved in stone. So let's just really get a bit of context here. Basically, maps aren't always designed to be kind of mathematically accurate representations. They always have some kind of meaning behind them. In this one really shows that it's not just about accuracy. This map has no accuracy whatsoever, but this represented the Neo-Babylonian worldview, where you have, it's kind of telling a philosophical story about the nature of the world. So maps that came around subsequently, that were more accurate and showed the world as a globe, they started to put humanity and be able to see ourselves as part of this bigger ecosystem. So fast forward very quickly to the early 1800s. This is by a guy called Alexander von Humboldt, who I think is an unsung hero of the kind of scientific legacy that we're building on. He was a geographer and an ecologist. And I think this is one of the early infographics. So what it shows is the it basically shows a very compressed version of mountain ranges and height distributions, and he's written all of the names of the species in there, and it transmits a huge amount of information very quickly that is, to a large extent, the kind of origin of our thinking about ecosystems and what an ecosystem is, and our understanding that different life forms are completely interconnected. So again, it's not really a map, but it's got a cross-section and it tells a story. And I think that's something important to remember when you're thinking about making maps. Sometimes it's more powerful if you forget about the kind of underlying data for a while and think about what you're trying to say. So that's another example of it. Okay, so moving on to spatial visualization in the R world. Again, So the geographic visualization R, this was from 2013, so getting much more recent now. It's been an accelerated history through time. And this is a comment from really what was a foundational book in geographic data with R, called Applied Spatial Data Analysis with R, ASDAR. And they said that they kind of owned up to the limitation that R doesn't have particularly interactive graphics. And they didn't know that just around the corner was coming a load of innovation in this area. So they so the authors of that book said it's got limited interactive facilities, despite what had happened previously with that example of manually zooming in and out. But 5 years later, and again, this is a quote from our book, an example showing R's flexibility and evolving geographic capabilities is Leaflet, which makes interactive maps. So suddenly that limitation has been completely overcome. And when I started using R for spatial data analysis during my PhD, I was really constrained by that. And I kept switching between R for the analysis and modeling, and then QGIS for the visualization. R for the modeling, and then QGIS for the visualization. And it's really great that you can do a huge amount of visualization. That's not to say you shouldn't use QGIS and other packages, but it's really moved on quite a long way. So I've got an example of early R graphics here, and you can see they work. They look quite kind of straightforward, I guess, but this code still runs 100%. So if you wanted to reproduce it, you can, but given that time is limited, I'm gonna crack on. It uses the base, it's quite heavily reliant on base R plotting, which again has its kind of pros and cons. It's fast, but it's quite rudimentary. The SF package that I've been advocating already, you run just that single command, plot NZ, and it gives you six faceted maps. So things have moved quite quickly, just in terms of the way that the default plot function works. So that's a good example of something that's moved forward very, very quickly, and it's now possible to create interactive visualizations very well. So in summary, if you want to use spatial data with R, you can use the Tidyverse. Could I get another little show of hands who regards themselves as a Tidyverse user? I probably do, yeah, okay. So again, the similar proportion. That means that you can play safely with spatial data in the Tidyverse if it's vector data. And vector data is points, lines, and polygons, essentially. The raster data format is less well supported. But this is basically a summary of, if you want to use spatial data in R, install the SF package, install the raster package, and then for data access, there's one called SP Data, and there's R Natural Earth, which provides access to loads of country boundaries and administrative zones. So there's a live demo in here, and I think it's worth just very quickly doing some of this, just conscious of time. I've got 20 minutes left. Well, okay, I'm going to do something. I'm going to save the live demo for the end so I get to the end of the slides without, and maybe we'll be able to do some live demoing during the questions as well that are going to come around. So I think I'm going to crack on instead of doing that. One thing to note though, and this is an important message of my slides, is that Tidyverse has a huge namespace, which means that it overwrites and masks other function names. So if you are already using Raster, be careful, because if you load the Tidyverse over Raster, it will make extract not work. So that's just something to be aware of. There's some pitfalls when you're using spatial data, which are really, really important to be aware of. So I'm going to cover some of those briefly. Just to say that reading spatial data works as you would expect with read_sf, and that's just an example from that. In terms of the structure of the objects, it's just a data frame. So this is a great innovation that spatial data is a data frame, but it has this special column called the geometry column, which behaves slightly differently, but in most ways the same as any other column. Okay, and the point of this slide is to show that this is a new innovation. So SP, which was the package that preceded SF, does not play with the Tidyverse. So if we try to do a filter, for example, on the world SP object, which we've converted into SP using this command, as world spatial, it's going to fail. So that's something nice that SF works. So basically use SF, not SP. And you can do filtering now with spatial data objects, and that just shows how that might work. The base R equivalent, and I think it's always good. I am not at all dogmatic about which you use. Some people prefer base and it has some advantages. You can also do the same thing using base R graphics. Okay, yeah, if I had more time, I'd talk about the differences between the outputs of those two things. But let's move on to talk about, well, aggregation. So you can easily, let's say you've got the countries of the world and you want it of the world, or even another kind of data set like the spatial lines data sets that I work with in transport. You can aggregate them and you can do all of the same operations that you would do as part of your data science workflow, but in spatial data. So I've got an example here that just shows how spatial data can be a little bit difficult or tricky. There's a lot of things that pop up, like in this case, let's say that you want to do an operation to find all countries that are within the touch of 500 kilometer buffer around London. If you do that, you're going to have a shock, because in this case you've got a country that's way out here that is associated with one of them, and that just shows there's subtleties in spatial data that you need to be aware of if you're using them. And the reason why that is happening is because some of the objects have multiple geometry. So you have a single line of a single row of data, but then it's got multiple polygons associated with it in the geometry column. So again, that's quite a subtle thing, but you can solve that problem by casting it to the polygon and then rerun the filter so that you're only getting the ones that you want. That's quite a kind of niche area. There's loads and loads of tricks on how to do these spatial operations in the book. So I just wanted to flag up with code example how that works. There are some pitfalls in there. So the Tidyverse does not keep row names. It cannot handle duplicate column names, which I don't think is a very big issue because you rarely have that. And still, if you use the Tidyverse, I'm going to do another very quick show of hands. Who uses bind rows if you use the Tidyverse? So a few people, it won't work with spatial data, use R-bind instead. So that's another thing just to be aware of. So basically you've got compatibility between these two big ecosystems, the spatial ecosystem and the tidyverse, and there's a huge amount of integration, but not everything works perfectly. That's the main message from this kind of live demo section, even though it's not that live, apologies. Going back to visualization, there are other ways to make maps. And my main recommendation to summarize is use TMap. Two words, use TMap. It's a fantastic package for creating maps, and you can create interactive maps, and you can create static maps like this one very quickly. It has a very similar syntax as ggplot2. And in fact, I should have added use TMap or ggplot2, because ggplot2 is also fantastic. But a big advantage of TMap is that you can use the same code to create an interactive web map. So I've got an example here. This is actually Leaflet, but you can see now that you can create interactive web maps very, very quickly and easily. And that's just great fun if you want to explore a spatial data set. Raster data in the tidyverse, I'm not going to cover this slide. Basically, it's not quite there yet. So there's a lot of development work in the future that's going to happen in raster data. So the final part of my talk, and conscious that I want to leave time for questions, so I believe I've got about 15 minutes left on the talky part, where before it becomes more interactive, is about evidence for policy. And this is something that I am passionate about. I'm not someone who just likes programming and writing code and making maps for the hell of it. I really do think it's important to think about, well, how is my code being used? How could it influence policy? So I've just got some thoughts on this that hopefully will lead to discussion. And again, I've got an example. So going back to that GIF of the spinning world that I showed at the beginning, there's a huge number of problems that we are facing that are becoming more serious in the future. An exciting thing is a lot of those problems are manifested through data, which can be studied using R, and some of those can be studied using geospatial data. So the case study that I'm picking out here is represented by this photo of a congested city. Does anyone have a guess what city this is? Yeah, it's Amsterdam. I've done this before. So this is Amsterdam in the 1970s, before they took political action to basically make it a much more safe environment. So the origins were a safety campaign, but this has led Amsterdam to be essentially a cycling utopia compared with other Northern European countries. And it's got a very high level of cycling, which means that all of the problems associated with this congestion are resolved, and the population is more healthy. There's less air pollution to breathe in, and it has a number of associated benefits. Another issue, a kind of more global issue, is that transport is a rapidly growing source of emissions, and I've just got a plot on there to show what the projections are for changes over time. I think that, yeah, this is from the IPCC stuff. So while most sectors are declining in emissions, transport is growing. So this is a reason why we need to do it. And there's a problem because people like to travel, and travel demand doesn't tend to saturate. Unlike eating or maybe heating your home, you reach a certain level and you're happy. With travel, and I'm guilty of this as well, I want to see more and more places. So you can get international jet setters who are just constantly going around the world, and it doesn't seem to have an upper limit of demand. So, and this is my final slide, the solution that I'm trying to push is to make the evidence of what could happen come alive. So create models that aren't just representing existing data, but have a kind of transparent way of showing policymakers and the public how the world could be different. So that means that your work goes from being about just describing existing data to modelling new stuff. And I'm just going to have one example from this final example. So just to explain here, PCT.bike is the first one that I showed, which had a map of cycling routes and cycling potential. And I showed a map of Manchester. CIT stands for the Cycling Infrastructure Prioritisation Toolkit, which is where we are representing scenarios of change on the road network. And that also runs across England. But this new one isn't actually deployed yet. It's a work in progress. And hopefully, if I can just open it up, it's just a showcase of what is possible, assuming the internet's working. So it may not be. But essentially what GeoPlummet is, it's actually another R package, yeah, it is working. That and I know Colin Kane, who's in the audience, has done work in this area as well. It's a way of joining up R analysis on the back end with JavaScript visualization on the front end. And basically, it's a framework for doing fancy data visuals. So instead of showing an app that's deployed, I'm kind of just demonstrating what is possible with new frameworks. So you don't have to use GeoPlummer. There's also a package called deck.gl. But basically, these fancy JavaScript libraries allow you to do quite cool things. Like, this is a 2.5D representation of simulated travel flows in New Zealand. And it's just an example of interactivity. So all of this is prototype stuff, but you can see how responsive that is, because this is just working on the JavaScript side. So that's kind of showing the direction of travel in terms of making your data come alive. I'm really interested in the gamification of transport planning. So let's try and make it a game, to make it fun, to get more people involved in it. And there's a huge amount of potential to do stuff here. So there's also challenges. When you're trying to deploy your research for to inform evidence, there's a tension between innovating and then just building another tool and having tool overload. People have already got loads going on. And that's something that you just need to balance. Maybe it's worth contributing to an existing tool rather than building a new one, and that's something that I've had to think about. There's also a balance, I think, between transparency of model and simplicity, which you need to communicate your model. On the one hand, that's very good, but on the other hand, you want to bring in complex data, and your modelling methodology will become more complex as you want to get closer to a representation. My way of dealing with that balance has always been towards simplicity and transparency of model is more important than showing some sophisticated analysis, because when you're communicating to policy makers, it's absolutely essential that they understand the assumptions on which your model's built. So that's another challenge. And the great thing is that R is an ideal language for helping to strike these balances. You can be transparent and you can use simple analyses, but you can also process very complex data sets and condense them down into compelling and hopefully policy relevant maps. So that's the end of my talk. I'm going to finish there to make time for questions. So thank you for listening. I hope you found that interesting.
Thanks very much, Robin. Has anybody got any questions they'd like to ask Robin? We've got a few minutes left before the flash talks. Any questions?